leave the blanket to stroll down the beach. A few minutes later, a second researcher, pretending to be a thief, would approach, grab the radio, and try to hurry away with it. As you might guess, under normal conditions, subjects were very reluctant to put themselves in harm's way by challenging the thief. Only 4 people did so in the 20 times that the theft was staged. But when the same procedure was tried another 20 times with a slight twist, the results were drastically different. In these incidents, before taking his stroll, the accomplice would simply ask the subject to please watch my things, which each of them agreed to do. Now, propelled by the rule for consistency, 19 of the 20 subjects became virtual vigilantes, running after and stopping the thief, demanding an explanation, and often restraining the thief physically, or snatching the radio away. To understand why consistency is so powerful a motive, it is important to recognize that in most circumstances, consistency is valued and adaptive. Inconsistency is commonly thought to be an undesirable personality trait. The person whose beliefs, words, and deeds don't match may be seen as indecisive, confused, two-faced, or even mentally ill. On the other side, a high degree of consistency is normally associated with personal and intellectual strength. It is at the heart of logic, rationality, stability, and honesty. A quote attributed to the great British chemist Michael Faraday suggests the extent to which being consistent is approved, sometimes more than being right. When asked after a lecture if he meant to imply that a hated academic rival was always wrong, Faraday glowered at the questioner and replied, "He's not that consistent." Certainly, then, good personal consistency is highly valued in our culture, and well it should be. It provides us with a reasonable and gainful orientation to the world. Most of the time, we will be better off if our approach to things is well-laced with consistency. Without it, our lives would be difficult, erratic, and disjointed. But because it is so typically in our best interests to be consistent, we easily fall into the habit of being automatically so, even in situations where it is not the sensible way to be. When it occurs unthinkingly, consistency can be disastrous. Nonetheless, even blind consistency has its attractions. First, like most other forms of automatic responding, it offers a shortcut through the density of modern life. Once we have made up our minds about an issue, stubborn consistency allows us a very appealing luxury. We really don't have to think hard about the issue anymore. We don't have to sift through the blizzard of information we encounter every day to identify relevant facts. We don't have to expend the mental energy to weigh the pros and cons. We don't have to make any further tough decisions. Instead, all we have to do when confronted with the issue is to turn on our consistency tape, whirr, and we know just what to believe, say, or do. We need only believe, say, or do whatever is consistent with our earlier decision. The allure of such a luxury is not to be minimized. It allows us a convenient, relatively effortless, and efficient method for dealing with complex, daily environments that make severe demands on our mental energies and capacities. It is not hard to understand, then, why automatic consistency is a difficult reaction to curb. It offers us a way to evade the rigors of continuing thought. And as Sir Joshua Reynolds noted, there is no expedient to which a man will not resort to avoid the real labor of thinking. With our consistency tapes operating, then, we can go about our business happily excused from the toil of having to think too much. There is a second, more perverse attraction of mechanical consistency as well. Sometimes it is not the effort of hard cognitive work that makes us shirk thoughtful activity, but the harsh consequences of that activity. Sometimes it is the cursedly clear and unwelcome set of answers provided by straight thinking that makes us mental slackers. There are certain disturbing things we simply would rather not realize. Because it is a pre-programmed and mindless method of responding, automatic consistency can supply a safe hiding place from those troubling realizations. Sealed within the fortress walls of rigid consistency, we can be impervious to the sieges of reason. One night, at an introductory lecture given by the Transcendental Meditation TM program, I witnessed a nice illustration of how people will hide inside the walls of consistency to protect themselves from the troublesome consequences of thought. The lecture itself was presided over by two earnest young men and was designed to recruit new members into the program. The program claimed it could teach a unique brand of meditation that would allow us to achieve all manner of desirable things, ranging from simple inner peace to the more spectacular abilities to fly and pass through walls at the program's advanced and more expensive stages. I had decided to attend the meeting to observe the kind of compliance tactics used in recruitment lectures of this sort, and had brought along an interested friend, a university professor whose areas of specialization were statistics and symbolic logic. As the meeting progressed and the lectures explained the theory behind TM, I noticed my logician friend becoming increasingly restless. Looking more and more pained and shifting about constantly in his seat, he was finally unable to resist. When the leaders called for questions at the completion of the lecture, he raised his hand and gently but surely demolished the presentation we had just heard. In less than 2 minutes, he pointed out precisely where and why the lecturer's complex argument was contradictory, illogical, and unsupportable. The effect on the discussion leaders was devastating. After a confused silence, each attempted a weak reply, only to halt midway to confer with his partner, and finally to admit that my colleague's points were good ones, requiring further study. More interesting to me, though, was the effect upon the rest of the audience. At the end of the question period, the two recruiters were faced with a crush of audience members submitting their $75 down payments for admission to the TM program, nudging, shrugging, and chuckling to one another as they took in the payments. The recruiters betrayed signs of giddy bewilderment. After what appeared to have been an embarrassingly clear collapse of their presentation, the meeting had somehow turned into a great success, generating mystifyingly high levels of compliance from the audience. Although more than a bit puzzled, I chalked up the audience response to a failure to understand the logic of my colleague's arguments. As it turned out, however, just the reverse was the case. Outside the lecture room after the meeting, we were approached by three members of the audience, each of whom had given a down payment immediately after the lecture. They wanted to know why we had come to the session. We explained, and we asked the same question of them. One was an aspiring actor who wanted desperately to succeed at his craft and had come to the meeting to learn if TM would allow him to achieve the necessary self-control to master the art. The recruiters had assured him that it would. The second described herself as a severe insomniac who had hopes that TM would provide her with a way to relax and fall asleep easily at night. The third served as unofficial spokesman. He also had a sleep-related problem. He was failing college because there didn't seem to be enough time to study. He had come to the meeting to find out if TM could help by training him to need fewer hours of sleep each night. The additional time could then be used for study. It is interesting to note that the recruiters informed him, as well as the insomniac, that transcendental meditation techniques could solve their respective, though opposite, problems. Still thinking that the three must have signed up because they hadn't understood the points made by my logician friend, I began to question them about aspects of his argument. To my surprise, I found that they had understood his comments quite well. In fact, all too well. It was precisely the cogency of his argument that drove them to sign up for the program on the spot. The spokesman put it best. "Well, I wasn't going to put down any money tonight because I'm really quite broke right now. I was going to wait until the next meeting. But when your buddy started talking, I knew I'd better give them my money now, or I'd go home and start thinking about what he said and never sign up." All at once, things began to make sense. These were people with real problems, and they were somewhat desperately searching for a way to solve those problems. They were seekers who, if our discussion leaders were to be believed, had found a potential solution in TM. Driven by their needs, they very much wanted to believe that TM was their answer. Now, in the form of my colleague, intrudes the voice of reason, showing the theory underlying their newfound solution to be unsound. "Panic," Something must be done at once before logic takes its toll and leaves them without hope again. Quickly, quickly, walls against reason are needed. And it doesn't matter that the fortress to be erected is a foolish one. Quick, a hiding place from thought. Here, take this money. Phew, safe in the nick of time. No need to think about the issues any longer. The decision has been made. And from now on, the consistency tape can be played whenever necessary. TM, certainly I think it will help me. Certainly I expect to continue. Certainly I believe in TM. I already put my money down for it, didn't I? Ah, the comforts of mindless consistency. I'll just rest right here for a while. It's so much nicer than the worry and strain of that hard, hard search. If, as it appears, automatic consistency functions as a shield against thought, it should not be surprising that such consistency can also be exploited by those who would prefer that we not think too much in response to their requests for our compliance. For the exploiters, whose interest will be served by an unthinking mechanical reaction to their requests, our tendency for automatic consistency is a gold mine. So clever are they at arranging to have us play our consistency tapes when it profits them that we seldom realize we have been taken. In fine jiu-jitsu fashion, they structure their interactions with us so that our own need to be consistent will lead directly to their benefit. Certain large toy manufacturers use just such an approach to reduce a problem caused by seasonal buying patterns. Of course, the boom time for toy sales occurs before and during the Christmas holiday season. The toy companies make fat profits during this period. Their problem is that toy sales then go into a terrible slump for the next couple of months. Their customers have already spent the full amount in their toy budgets and are stiffly resistant to their children's pleas for more. Even those children whose birthdays fall soon after the holidays receive fewer toys because of the recent Christmas spree. So the toy manufacturers are faced with a dilemma. How to keep sales high during the peak season and, at the same time, retain a healthy demand for toys in the immediately following months. The difficulty certainly doesn't lie in convincing our naturally insatiable offspring to want a continuous flow of new amusements. A series of flashy television commercials placed among the Saturday morning cartoon shows will produce the usual amounts of begging, whining, and wheedling, no matter when it appears during the year. No, the problem is not in motivating kids to want more toys after Christmas. The problem is in motivating post-holiday spent-out parents to reach down for the price of yet another plaything for their already toy-glutted children. What could the toy companies possibly do to produce that unlikely behavior? Some have tried a greatly increased advertising campaign. Others have reduced prices during the slack period. But neither of those standard sales devices has proved successful. Not only are both tactics costly, but both have also been ineffective in increasing sales to desired levels. Parents are simply not in a toy-buying mood, and the influences of advertising or reduced expense are not enough to shake that stony resistance. Certain large toy manufacturers, however, think they have found a solution. It's an ingenious one, involving no more than a normal advertising expense and an understanding of the powerful pull of the need for consistency. My first hint of how the toy company's strategy worked came after I fell for it, and then, in true Patsy form, fell for it again. It was January, and I was in the town's largest toy store. After purchasing all too many gifts there for my son a month before, I had sworn not to enter that place or any like it for a long, long time. Yet there I was, not only in the diabolic place, but also in the process of buying my son another expensive toy, a big electric road race set. In front of the road race display, I happened to meet a former neighbor who was buying his son the same toy. The odd thing was that we almost never saw each other anymore. In fact, the last time was a year earlier, in that same store, when we were both buying our sons an expensive post-Christmas gift. That time, a robot that walked, talked, and laid waste. We laughed about our strange pattern of seeing each other only once a year at the same time, in the same place, while doing the same thing? Later that day, I mentioned the coincidence to a friend who, it turned out, had once worked in the toy business. "No coincidence," he said knowingly. "What do you mean, no coincidence?" "Look," he said, "let me ask you a couple of questions about the road race set you bought this year. First, did you promise your son that he'd get one for Christmas?" "Well, yes, I did." Christopher had seen a bunch of ads for them on the Saturday morning cartoon shows and said that was what he wanted for Christmas. I saw a couple of the ads myself, and it looked like fun. So I said okay. "Strike one," he announced. "Now for my second question. When you went to buy one, did you find all the stores sold out?" "That's right, I did." "The stores said they'd ordered some but didn't know when they'd get any more in. So I had to buy Christopher some other toys to make up for the road race set." "But how did you know?" "Strike two," he said. "Just let me ask one more question. Didn't this same sort of thing happen the year before with the robot toy?" "Wait a minute. You're right. That's just what happened. This is incredible. How did you know?" "No psychic powers. I just happened to know how several of the big toy companies jack up their January and February sales. They start prior to Christmas with attractive TV ads for certain special toys. The kids, naturally, want what they see and extract Christmas promises for those items from their parents. Now, here's where the genius of the company's plan comes in. They undersupply the stores with the toys they've gotten the parents to promise. Most parents find those things sold out and are forced to substitute other toys of equal value. The toy manufacturers, of course, make a point of supplying the stores with plenty of these substitutes. Then, after Christmas, the companies start running the ads again for the other special toys. That juices up the kids to want those toys more than ever. They go running to the parents, whining, "You promised, you promised." And the adults go trudging off to the store to live up dutifully to their words. "Where," I said, beginning to seethe now, "they meet other parents they haven't seen for a year, falling for the same trick, right?" "Right. Where are you going?" "I'm going to take that road race set right back to the store." I was so angry I was nearly shouting. "Wait, think for a minute first. Why did you buy it this morning?" "Because I didn't want to let Christopher down, and because I wanted to teach him that promises are to be lived up to." "Well, has any of that changed?" "Look, if you take his toy away now, he won't understand why. He'll just know that his father broke a promise to him. Is that what you want?" "No," I said, sighing. "I guess not. So you're telling me that they doubled their profit on me for the past 2 years, and I never even knew it. And now that I do, I'm still trapped by my own words. So what you're really telling me is strike three." He nodded. "And you're out." Commitment is the key. Once we realize that the power of consistency is formidable in directing human action, an important practical question immediately arises. How is that force engaged? What produces the click that activates the whirr of the powerful consistency tape? Social psychologists think they know the answer. Commitment. If I can get you to make a commitment, that is, to take a stand, to go on record, I will have set the stage for your automatic and ill-considered consistency with that earlier commitment. Once a stand is taken, there is a natural tendency to behave in ways that are stubbornly consistent with the stand. As we've already seen, social psychologists are not the only ones who understand the connection between commitment and consistency. Commitment strategies are aimed at us by compliance professionals of nearly every sort. Each of the strategies is intended to get us to take some action or make some statement that will trap us into later compliance through consistency pressures. Procedures designed to create commitment take various forms. Some are fairly straightforward. Others are among the most subtle compliance tactics we will encounter. For instance, suppose you wanted to increase the number of people in your area who would agree to go door-to-door collecting donations for your favorite charity. You would be wise to study the approach taken by social psychologist Stephen J. Sherman. He simply called a sample of Bloomington, Indiana residents as part of a survey he was taking and ask them to predict what they would say if asked to spend 3 hours collecting money for the American Cancer Society. Of course, not wanting to seem uncharitable to the survey taker or to themselves, many of these people said that they would volunteer. The consequence of this sly commitment procedure was a 700% increase in volunteers when, a few days later, a representative of the American Cancer Society did call and ask for neighborhood canvassers. Using the same strategy, but this time asking Columbus, Ohio residents to predict whether they would vote on Election Day, a team of researchers led by Anthony Greenwald were able to increase significantly the turnout in a U.S. presidential election among those called. Perhaps an even more crafty commitment technique has been developed recently by telephone solicitors for charity. Have you noticed that callers asking you to contribute to some cause or another these days seem to begin things by inquiring about your current health and well-being? "Hello, Mr. or Ms. Target Person," they say. "How are you feeling this evening?" Or, "How are you doing today?" The caller's intent with this sort of introduction is not merely to seem friendly and caring. It is to get you to respond, as you normally do to such polite, superficial inquiries, with a polite, superficial comment of your own, "Just fine," or "Real good," or "I'm doing great, thanks." Once you have publicly stated that all is well, it becomes much easier for the solicitor to corner you into aiding those for whom all is not well. I'm glad to hear that, because I'm calling to ask if you'd be willing to make a donation to help out the unfortunate victims of... The theory behind this tactic is that people who have just asserted that they are feeling fine, even as a routine part of a sociable exchange, will consequently find it awkward to appear stingy in the context of their own admittedly favored circumstances. If all this sounds a bit far-fetched, consider the findings of consumer researcher Daniel Howard, who put the theory to test. Dallas, Texas residents were called on the phone and asked if they would agree to allow a representative of the Hunger Relief Committee to come to their homes to sell them cookies, the proceeds from which would be used to supply meals for the needy. When tried alone, that request, labeled the standard solicitation approach, produced only 18% agreement. However, if the caller initially asked, "How are you feeling this evening?" and waited for a reply before proceeding to the standard approach, several noteworthy things happened. First, of the 120 individuals called, most, 108, gave the customary favorable reply, "Good, fine, real well, etc." Second, 32% of the people who got the "How are you feeling tonight?" question agreed to receive the cookie seller at their homes, nearly twice the success rate of the standard solicitation approach. Third, true to the consistency principle, almost everyone who agreed to such a visit did in fact make a cookie purchase when contacted at home, 89%. To make sure that this tactic doesn't generate its successes simply because a solicitor who uses it seems more concerned and courteous than one who doesn't use it, Howard conducted another study. This time, callers began either with the question, "How are you feeling this evening?" and waited for a response before proceeding, or with the statement, "I hope you're feeling well this evening," and then proceeded to the standard solicitation approach. Despite the fact that the caller started each type of interaction with a warm and friendly comment, the "how are you feeling" technique was by far superior to its rival, 33% versus 15% compliance, because it alone drew an exploitable public commitment from its targets. Note that the commitment was able to get twice as much compliance from those targets, even though at the time it occurred, it must have seemed to them an altogether inconsequential reply to an altogether superficial question. Yet another fine example of social jiu-jitsu at work. The question of what makes a commitment effective has a number of answers. A variety of factors affect the ability of a commitment to constrain our future behavior. One large-scale program designed to produce compliance illustrates nicely how several of the factors work. The remarkable thing about this program is that it was systematically employing these factors decades ago, well before scientific research had identified them. During the Korean War, many captured American soldiers found themselves in prisoner of war, POW camps, run by the Chinese communists. It became clear early in the conflict that the Chinese treated captives quite differently than did their allies, the North Koreans, who favored savagery and harsh punishment to gain compliance. Specifically avoiding the appearance of brutality, the Red Chinese engaged in what they termed their lenient policy, which was in reality a concerted and sophisticated psychological assault on their captives. After the war, American psychologists questioned the returning prisoners intensively to determine what had occurred. The intensive psychological investigation took place in part because of the unsettling success of some aspects of the Chinese program. For example, the Chinese were very effective in getting Americans to inform on one another, in striking contrast to the behavior of American POWs in World War II. For this reason, among others, escape plans were quickly uncovered, and the escape attempts themselves almost always unsuccessful. When an escape did occur, wrote Dr. Edgar Schein, a principal American investigator of the Chinese indoctrination program in Korea, the Chinese usually recovered the man easily by offering a bag of rice to anyone turning him in. In fact, nearly all American prisoners in the Chinese camps are said to have collaborated with the enemy in one form or another. An examination of the Chinese prison camp program shows that its personnel relied heavily on commitment and consistency pressures to gain the desired compliance from prisoners. Of course, the first problem facing the Chinese was how to get any collaboration at all from the Americans. These were men who were trained to provide nothing but name, rank, and serial number. Short of physical brutalization, how could the captors hope to get such men to give military information, turn in fellow prisoners, or publicly denounce their country? The Chinese answer was elementary. Start small and build. For instance, prisoners were frequently asked to make statements so mildly anti-American or pro-communist as to seem inconsequential. The United States is not perfect. In a communist country, unemployment is not a problem. But once these minor requests were complied with, the men found themselves pushed to submit to related yet more substantive requests. A man who had just agreed with his Chinese interrogator that the United States is not perfect might then be asked to indicate some of the ways in which he thought this was the case. Once he had so explained himself, he might be asked to make a list of these problems with America and to sign his name to it. Later, he might be asked to read his list in a discussion group with other prisoners. After all, it's what you really believe, isn't it? Still later, he might be asked to write an essay expanding on his list and discussing these problems in greater detail. The Chinese might then use his name and his essay in an anti-American radio broadcast beamed not only to the entire camp, but to other POW camps in North Korea, as well as to American forces in South Korea. Suddenly, he would find himself a collaborator, having given aid to the enemy. Aware that he had written the essay without any strong threats or coercion, many times a man would change his image of himself to be consistent with the deed and with the new collaborator label, often resulting in even more extensive acts of collaboration. Thus, while only a few men were able to avoid collaboration altogether, according to Dr. Schein, the majority collaborated at one time or another by doing things which seemed to them trivial, but which the Chinese were able to turn to their own advantage. This was particularly effective in eliciting confessions, self-criticism, and information during interrogation. If the Chinese know about the subtle power of this approach, it should not be surprising that another group of people interested in compliance is also aware of its usefulness. Many business organizations employ it regularly. For the salesperson, the strategy is to obtain a large purchase by starting with a small one. Almost any sale will do, because the purpose of that small transaction is not profit, it is commitment. Further purchases, even much larger ones, are expected to flow naturally from the commitment. An article in the trade magazine American Salesman put it succinctly. The general idea is to pave the way for full line distribution by starting with a small order. Look at it this way. When a person has signed an order for your merchandise, Even though the profit is so small, it hardly compensates for the time and effort of making the call. He is no longer a prospect. He is a customer. The tactic of starting with a little request in order to gain eventual compliance with related larger requests has a name, the foot-in-the-door technique. Social scientists first became aware of its effectiveness in the mid-1960s, when psychologists Jonathan Friedman and Scott Fraser published an astonishing set of data. They reported the results of an experiment in which a researcher posing as a volunteer worker had gone door to door in a residential California neighborhood, making a preposterous request of homeowners. The homeowners were asked to allow a public service billboard to be installed on their front lawns. To get an idea of just how the sign would look, they were shown a photograph depicting an attractive house, the view of which was almost completely obscured by a very large, poorly lettered sign reading, "Drive Carefully." Although the request was normally and understandably refused by the great majority, 83% of the other residents in the area, this particular group of people reacted quite favorably. A full 76% of them offered the use of their front yards. The prime reason for their startling compliance has to do with something that had happened to them about 2 weeks earlier. They had made a small commitment to driver safety. A different volunteer worker had come to their doors and asked them to accept and display a little 3-inch square sign that read, "Be a safe driver." It was such a trifling request that nearly all of them had agreed to it. But the effects of that request were enormous. Because they had innocently complied with a trivial safe driving request a couple of weeks before, these homeowners became remarkably willing to comply with another such request that was massive in size. Friedman and Fraser didn't stop there. They tried a slightly different procedure on another sample of homeowners. These people first received a request to sign a petition that favored keeping California beautiful. Of course, nearly everyone signed, since state beauty, like efficiency in government or sound prenatal care, is one of those issues almost no one is against. After waiting about 2 weeks, Friedman and Fraser sent a new volunteer worker to these same homes to ask the residents to allow the "Big Drive Carefully" sign to be erected on their lawns. In some ways, their response was the most astounding of any of the homeowners in the study. Approximately half of these people consented to the installation of the "Drive Carefully" billboard, even though the small commitment they had made weeks earlier was not to driver safety, but to an entirely different public service topic, state beautification. At first, even Friedman and Fraser were bewildered by their findings. Why should the little act of signing a petition supporting state beautification cause people to be so willing to perform a different and much larger favor? After considering and discarding other explanations, Friedman and Fraser came upon one that offered a solution to the puzzle. Signing the beautification petition changed the view these people had of themselves. They saw themselves as public-spirited citizens who acted on their civic principles. When, 2 weeks later, they were asked to perform another public service by displaying the "Drive Carefully" sign, they complied in order to be consistent with their newly formed self-images. According to Friedman and Fraser, "What may occur is a change in the person's feelings about getting involved or taking action. Once he has agreed to a request, his attitude may change. He may become, in his own eyes, the kind of person who does this sort of thing, who agrees to requests made by strangers, who takes action on things he believes in, who cooperates with good causes." What the Friedman and Fraser findings tell us, then, is to be very careful about agreeing to trivial requests. Such an agreement can not only increase our compliance with very similar, much larger requests, it can also make us more willing to perform a variety of larger favors that are only remotely connected to the little one we did earlier. It's this second, general kind of influence concealed within small commitments that scares me. It scares me enough that I am rarely willing to sign a petition anymore, even for a position I support. Such an action has the potential to influence not only my future behavior, but also my self-image in ways I may not want. And once a person's self-image is altered, all sorts of subtle advantages become available to someone who wants to exploit that new image. Who among Friedman and Fraser's homeowners would have thought that the volunteer worker who asked them to sign a state beautification petition was really interested in having them display a safe driving billboard 2 weeks later? And who among them could have suspected that their decision to display the billboard was largely due to the act of signing the petition? No one, I'd guess. If there were any regrets after the billboard went up, who could they conceivably hold responsible but themselves and their own damnably strong civic spirit? They probably never even considered the guy with the Keeping California Beautiful petition and all that knowledge of jiu-jitsu. Notice that all of the foot-in-the-door experts seem to be excited about the same thing. You can use small commitments to manipulate a person's self-image. You can use them to turn citizens into public servants, prospects into customers, prisoners into collaborators. And once you've got a man's self-image where you want it, he should comply naturally with a whole range of your requests that are consistent with this view of himself. Not all commitments affect self-image, however. There are certain conditions that should be present for a commitment to be effective in this way. To discover what they are, we can once again look to the American experience in the Chinese prison camps of Korea. It is important to understand that the major intent of the Chinese was not simply to extract information from their prisoners. It was to indoctrinate them, to change their attitudes and perceptions of themselves, of their political system, of their country's role in the war, and of communism. And there is evidence that the program often worked alarmingly well. Dr. Henry Siegel, chief of the neuropsychiatric evaluation team that examined returning POWs at the war's end, reported that war-related beliefs had been substantially shifted. The majority of the men believed the Chinese story that the United States had used germ warfare, and many felt that their own forces had been the initial aggressors in starting the war. Similar inroads had been made in the political attitudes of the men. Many expressed antipathy toward the Chinese communists, but at the same time praised them for the fine job they have done in China. Others stated that, although communism won't work in America, I think it's a good thing for Asia. It appears that the real goal of the Chinese was to modify, at least for a time, the hearts and minds of their captives. If we measure their achievement in terms of defection, disloyalty, changed attitudes and beliefs, poor discipline, poor morale, poor esprit, and doubts as to America's role, Dr. Siegel concluded that their efforts were highly successful. Because commitment tactics were so much a part of the effective Chinese assault on hearts and minds, it is quite informative to examine the specific features of the tactics they used. The Magic Act. Our best evidence of what people truly feel and believe comes less from their words than from their deeds. Observers trying to decide what a man is like look closely at his actions. What the Chinese have discovered is that a man himself uses this same evidence to decide what he is like. His behavior tells him about himself. It is a primary source of information about his beliefs and values and attitudes. Understanding fully this important principle of self-perception, the Chinese set about arranging the prison camp experience so that their captives would consistently act in desired ways. Before long, the Chinese knew these actions would begin to take their toll, causing the men to change their views of themselves to align with what they had done. Writing was one sort of confirming action that the Chinese urged incessantly upon the men. It was never enough for the prisoners to listen quietly or even to agree verbally with the Chinese line. They were always pushed to write it down as well. So intent were the Chinese on securing a written statement that if a prisoner was not willing to write a desired response freely, he was prevailed upon to copy it. The American psychologist Edgar Schein describes a standard indoctrination session tactic of the Chinese in these terms. A further technique was to have the man write out the question and then the pro-communist answer. If he refused to write it voluntarily, he was asked to copy it from the notebooks, which must have seemed like a harmless enough concession. But oh, those harmless concessions. We've already seen how apparently trifling commitments can lead to extraordinary further behavior. And the Chinese knew that. As a commitment device, a written declaration has some great advantages. First, it provides physical evidence that the act occurred. Once a man wrote what the Chinese wanted, it was very difficult for him to believe that he had not done so. The opportunities to forget or to deny to himself what he had done were not available, as they are for purely verbal statements. No, there it was in his own handwriting, an irrevocably documented act driving him to make his beliefs and his self-image consistent with what he had undeniably done. A second advantage of a written testament is that it can be shown to other people. Of course, that means it can be used to persuade those people. It can persuade them to change their own attitudes in the direction of the statement. But more important for the purpose of commitment, it can persuade them that the author genuinely believes what was written. People have a natural tendency to think that a statement reflects the true attitude of the person who made it. What is surprising is that they continue to think so even when they know that the person did not freely choose to make the statement. Some scientific evidence that this is the case comes from a study by psychologists Edward Jones and James Harris, who showed people an essay that was favorable to Fidel Castro and asked them to guess the true feelings of its author. Jones and Harris told some of these people that the author had chosen to write a pro-Castro essay, and they told the other people that the author had been required to write in favor of Castro. The strange thing was that even those people who knew that the author had been assigned to do a pro-Castro essay guessed that he liked Castro. It seems that a statement of belief produces a click-whir response in those who view it. Unless there is strong evidence to the contrary, observers automatically assume that someone who makes such a statement means it. Think of the double-barreled effects on the self-image of a prisoner who wrote a pro-Chinese or anti-American statement. Not only was it a lasting personal reminder of his action, it was also likely to persuade those around him that the statement reflected his actual beliefs. And as we will see in Chapter 4, what those around us think is true of us is enormously important in determining what we ourselves think is true. For example, one study found that after hearing that they were considered charitable people, New Haven, Connecticut housewives gave much more money to a canvasser from the Multiple Sclerosis Association. Apparently, the mere knowledge that someone viewed them as charitable caused these women to make their actions consistent with another's perception of them. Once an active commitment is made, then, self-image is squeezed from both sides by consistency pressures. From the inside, there is a pressure to bring self-image into line with action. From the outside, there is a sneakier pressure, a tendency to adjust this image according to the way others perceive us. And because others see us as believing what we have written, even when we've had little choice in the matter, we will once again experience a pull to bring self-image into line with the written statement. In Korea, several subtle devices were used to get the prisoners to write, without direct coercion, what the Chinese wanted. For example, the Chinese knew that many prisoners were eager to let their families know that they were alive. At the same time, the men knew that their captors were censoring the mails and that only some letters were being allowed out of camp. To ensure that their own letters would be released, some prisoners began including in their messages peace appeals, claims of kind treatment, and statements sympathetic to communism. The hope was that the Chinese would want such letters to surface and would therefore allow their delivery. Of course, the Chinese were happy to cooperate because those letters served their interests marvelously. First, their worldwide propaganda effort benefited greatly from the appearance of pro-communist statements by American servicemen. Second, in the service of prisoner indoctrination, they had, without raising a finger of physical force, gotten many men to go on record as supporting the Chinese cause. A similar technique involved political essay contests that were regularly held in camp. The prizes for winning were invariably small, a few cigarettes or a bit of fruit, but were sufficiently scarce that they generated a lot of interest from the men. Usually the winning essay was one that took a solidly pro-communist stand, but not always. The Chinese were wise enough to realize that most of the prisoners would not enter a contest that they could win only by writing a communist tract. And the Chinese were clever enough to know how to plant small commitments to communism in the men that could be nurtured into later bloom. So the prize was occasionally given to an essay that generally supported the United States, but that bowed once or twice to the Chinese view. The effects of this strategy were exactly what the Chinese wanted. The men continued to participate voluntarily in the contest because they saw that they could win with an essay highly favorable to their own country. But perhaps without realizing it, they began to shade their essays a bit toward communism in order to have a better chance of winning. The Chinese were ready to pounce on any concession to communist dogma and to bring consistency pressures to bear upon it. In the case of a written declaration within a voluntary essay, they had a perfect commitment from which to build toward collaboration and conversion. Other compliance professionals also know about the committing power of written statements. The enormously successful Amway Corporation, for instance, has hit upon a way to spur their sales personnel to greater and greater accomplishments. Members of the staff are asked to set individual sales goals and commit themselves to those goals by personally recording them on paper. One final tip before you get started, set a goal and write it down. Whatever the goal, the important thing is that you set it, so you've got something for which to aim and that you write it down. There is something magical about writing things down. So set a goal and write it down. When you reach that goal, set another and write that down. You'll be off and running. If the Amway people have found something magical about writing things down, so have other business organizations. Some door-to-door sales companies use the magic of written commitments to battle the cooling-off laws recently passed in many states. The laws are designed to allow customers a few days after purchasing an item to cancel the sale and receive a full refund. At first, this legislation hurt the hard-sell companies deeply. Because they emphasize high-pressure tactics, their customers often buy not because they want the product, but because they are duped or intimidated into the sale. When the new laws went into effect, these customers began canceling in droves. The companies have since learned a beautifully simple trick that cuts the number of such cancellations drastically. They merely have the customer, rather than the salesman, fill out the sales agreement. According to the sales training program of a prominent encyclopedia company, that personal commitment alone has proved to be a very important psychological aid in preventing customers from backing out of their contracts. Like the Amway Corporation, then, these organizations have found that something special happens when people personally put their commitments on paper. They live up to what they have written down. Another common way for businesses to cash in on the magic of written declarations occurs through the use of an innocent-looking promotional device. Before I began to study weapons of social influence, I used to wonder why big companies such as Procter & Gamble and General Foods are always running those 25, 50, or 100 words or less testimonial contests. They all seem to be alike. The contestant is to compose a short personal statement that begins with the words, "Why I like," and goes on to laud the features of whatever cake mix or floor wax happens to be at issue. The company judges the entries and awards some stunningly large prizes to the winners. What has puzzled me was what the companies got out of the deal. Often the contest requires no purchase. Anyone submitting an entry is eligible. Yet the companies appear to be strangely willing to incur the huge costs of contest after contest. I am no longer puzzled. The purpose behind the testimonial contests is the same as the purpose behind the political essay contests of the Chinese communists. In both instances, the aim is to get as many people as possible to go on record as liking the product. In Korea, the product was a brand of Chinese communism. In the United States, it might be a brand of cuticle remover. The type of product doesn't matter. The process is the same. Participants voluntarily write essays for attractive prizes that they have only a small chance to win, but they know that for an essay to have any chance of winning at all, it must include praise for the product. So they find praiseworthy features of the product and describe them in their essays. The result is hundreds of men in Korea, or hundreds of thousands of people in America who testify in writing to the product's appeal and who consequently experience that magical pull to believe what they have written. The public eye. One reason that written testaments are effective in bringing about genuine personal change is that they can so easily be made public. The prisoner experience in Korea showed the Chinese to be quite aware of an important psychological principle. Public commitments tend to be lasting commitments. The Chinese constantly arranged to have the pro-communist statements of their captives seen by others. A man who had written a political essay the Chinese liked, for example, might find copies of it posted around camp, or might be asked to read it to a prisoner discussion group, or even to read it on the camp radio broadcast. As far as the Chinese were concerned, the more public, the better. Why? Whenever one takes a stand that is visible to others, there arises a drive to maintain that stand in order to look like a consistent person. Remember that earlier in this chapter, we described how desirable good personal consistency is as a trait? How someone without it could be judged as fickle, uncertain, pliant, scatterbrained, or unstable? How someone with it is viewed as rational, assured, trustworthy, and sound? Given this context, it is hardly surprising that people try to avoid the look of inconsistency. For appearance's sake, then, the more public a stand, the more reluctant we will be to change it. An illustration of how public commitments can lead to doggedly consistent further action is provided in a famous experiment performed by a pair of prominent social psychologists, Morton Deutsch and Harold Gerard. The basic procedure was to have college students first estimate in their own minds the length of lines they were shown. At this point, one sample of the students had to commit themselves publicly to their initial judgments by writing them down, signing their names to them, and turning them in to the experimenter. A second sample of students also committed themselves to their first estimates, but they did so privately by putting them on a magic writing pad and then erasing them by lifting the magic pad's plastic cover before anyone could see what they had written. A third set of students did not commit themselves to their initial estimates at all. They just kept the estimates in mind privately. In these ways, Deutsch and Gerard had cleverly arranged for some students to commit themselves publicly, some privately, and some not at all to their initial decisions. What Deutsch and Gerard wanted to find out was which of the three types of students would be most inclined to stick with their first judgments after receiving information that those judgments were incorrect. So all of the students were given new evidence suggesting that their initial estimates were wrong, and they were then given the chance to change their estimates. The results were quite clear. The students who had never written down their first choices were the least loyal to those choices. When new evidence was presented that questioned the wisdom of decisions that had never left their heads, these students were the most influenced by the new information to change what they had viewed as the correct decision. Compared to these uncommitted students, those who had merely written their decisions for a moment on a magic pad were significantly less willing to change their minds when given the chance. Even though they had committed themselves under the most anonymous of circumstances, the act of writing down their first judgments caused them to resist the influence of contradictory new data and to remain consistent with the preliminary choices. But Deutsch and Gerard found that by far it was the students who had publicly recorded their initial positions who most resolutely refused to shift from those positions later. Public commitment had hardened them into the most stubborn of all. This sort of stubbornness can occur even in situations where accuracy should be more important than consistency. In one study, when 6 or 12 person experimental juries were deciding a close case, hung juries were significantly more frequent if the jurors had to express their opinions with a visible show of hands rather than by secret ballot. Once jurors had stated their initial views publicly, they were reluctant to allow themselves to change publicly either. Should you ever find yourself as the foreperson of a jury under these conditions, then you could reduce the risk of a hung jury by choosing a secret rather than public balloting technique. The Deutsch and Girard finding that we are truest to our decisions if we have bound ourselves to them publicly can be put to good use. Consider the organizations dedicated to helping people rid themselves of bad habits. Many weight reduction clinics, for instance, understand that often a person's private decision to lose weight will be too weak to withstand the blandishments of bakery windows, wafting cooking scents, and late-night Sara Lee commercials. So they see to it that the decision is buttressed by the pillars of public commitment. They require their clients to write down an immediate weight loss goal and show that goal to as many friends, relatives, and neighbors as possible. Clinic operators report that frequently this simple technique works where all else has failed. Of course, there's no need to pay a special clinic in order to engage a visible commitment as an ally. One San Diego woman described to me how she employed a public promise to help herself finally stop smoking. I remember it was after I heard about another scientific study showing that smoking causes cancer. Every time one of those things came out, I used to get determined to quit, but I never could. This time, though, I decided I had to do something. I'm a proud person. It matters to me if other people see me in a bad light. So I thought, maybe I can use that pride to help me dump this damn habit. So I made a list of all the people who I really wanted to respect me. Then I went out and got some blank business cards, and I wrote on the back of each card, "I promise you that I will never smoke another cigarette." Within a week, I had given or sent a signed card to everybody on the list. My dad, my brother back east, my boss, my best girlfriend, my ex-husband, everybody but one. The guy I was dating then. I was just crazy about him, and I really wanted him to value me as a person. Believe me, I thought twice about giving him a card because I knew that if I couldn't keep my promise to him, I'd die. But one day at the office, he worked in the same building as I did, I just walked up to him, handed him the card, and walked away without saying anything. Quitting cold turkey was the hardest thing I've ever done. There must have been a thousand times when I thought I had to have a smoke. But whenever that happened, I just picture how all of the people on my list, especially this one guy, would think less of me if I couldn't stick to my guns. And that's all it took. I've never taken another puff. You know, the interesting thing is, the guy turned out to be a real schmuck. I can't figure out what I saw in him back then, but at the time, without knowing it, he helped me get through the toughest part of the toughest thing I've ever had to do. I don't even like him anymore. Still, I do feel grateful in a way because I think he saved my life. The effort extra. Yet another reason that written commitments are so effective is that they require more work than verbal ones. And the evidence is clear that the more effort that goes into a commitment, the greater is its ability to influence the attitudes of the person who made it. We can find that evidence quite close to home or as far away as the back regions of the primitive world. For example, there is a tribe in southern Africa, the Thonga, that requires each of its boys to go through an elaborate initiation ceremony before he can be counted a man of the tribe. As with many other primitive peoples, a Thonga boy endures a great deal before he is admitted to adult membership in the group. Anthropologists Whiting, Kluckhohn, and Anthony have described this 3-month ordeal in brief but vivid terms. When a boy is somewhere between 10 and 16 years of age, he is sent by his parents to circumcision school, which is held every 4 or 5 years. Here in company with his age mates, he undergoes severe hazing by the adult males of the society. The initiation begins when each boy runs the gauntlet between 2 rows of men who beat him with clubs. At the end of this experience, he is stripped of his clothes and his hair is cut. He is next met by a man covered with lion manes, and is seated upon a stone, facing this lion man. Someone then strikes him from behind, and when he turns his head to see who has struck him, his foreskin is seized, and in 2 movements cut off by the lion man. Afterward, he is secluded for 3 months in the Yard of Mysteries, where he can be seen only by the initiated. During the course of his initiation, the boy undergoes 6 major trials: beatings, exposure to cold, thirst, eating of unsavory foods, punishment, and the threat of death. On the slightest pretext, he may be beaten by one of the newly initiated men, who was assigned to the task by the older men of the tribe. He sleeps without covering and suffers bitterly from the winter cold. He is forbidden to drink a drop of water during the whole 3 months. Meals are often made nauseating by the half-digested grass from the stomach of an antelope, which is poured over his food. If he is caught breaking any important rule governing the ceremony, he is severely punished. For example, in one of these punishments, sticks are placed between the fingers of the offender. Then a strong man closes his hand around that of the novice, practically crushing his fingers. He is frightened into submission by being told that in former times boys who had tried to escape, or who had revealed the secrets to women or to the uninitiated, were hanged and their bodies burned to ashes. On the face of it, these rites seem extraordinary and bizarre. Yet at the same time, they can be seen to be remarkably similar in principle, and even in detail, to the common initiation ceremonies of school fraternities. During the traditional Hell Week held yearly on college campuses, fraternity pledges must persevere through a variety of activities designed by the older members to test the limits of physical exertion, psychological strain, and social embarrassment. At the week's end, the boys who have persisted through the ordeal are accepted for full group membership. Mostly, their tribulations have left them no more than greatly tired and a bit shaky, although sometimes the negative effects are more serious. What is interesting is how closely the particular features of Hell Week tasks match those of the tribal initiation rites. Recall that anthropologists identified 6 major trials to be endured by a Fonga initiate during his stay in the Yard of Mysteries. A scan of newspaper reports shows that each trial also has its place in the hazing rituals of Greek letter societies. Beatings. 14-year-old Michael Caligris spent 3 weeks in a Long Island hospital recovering from internal injuries suffered during a Hell Night initiation ceremony of his high school fraternity, Omega Gamma Delta. He had been administered the atomic bomb by his prospective brothers, who told him to hold his hands over his head and keep them there while they gathered around to slam fists into his stomach and back simultaneously and repeatedly. Exposure to cold. On a winter night, Frederick Bronner, a California junior college student, was taken 3,000 feet up and 10 miles into the hills of a national forest by his prospective fraternity brothers. Left to find his way home wearing only a thin sweatshirt and slacks, Fat Freddy, as he was called, shivered in a frigid wind until he tumbled down a steep ravine, fracturing bones and hurting his head. Prevented by his injuries from going on, he huddled there against the cold until he died of exposure. Thirst. 2 Ohio State University freshmen found themselves in the dungeon of their prospective fraternity house after breaking the rule requiring all pledges to crawl into the dining area prior to Hell Week meals. Once locked in the house storage closet, they were given only salty foods to eat for nearly 2 days. Nothing was provided for drinking purposes except a pair of plastic cups in which they could catch their own urine. Eating of unsavory foods. At Kappa Sigma House on the campus of the University of Southern California, the eyes of 11 pledges bulged when they saw the sickening task before them. 11 quarter-pound slabs of raw liver lay on a tray. Cut thick and soaked in oil, each was to be swallowed whole, one to a boy. Gagging and choking repeatedly, young Richard Swanson failed 3 times to down his piece. Determined to succeed, he finally got the oil-soaked meat into his throat where it lodged and, despite all efforts to remove it, killed him. Punishment. In Wisconsin, a pledge who forgot one section of a ritual incantation to be memorized by all initiates was punished for his error. He was required to keep his feet under the rear legs of a folding chair while the heaviest of his fraternity brothers sat down and drank a beer. Although the pledge did not cry out during the punishment, a bone in each of his feet was broken. Threats of death. A pledge at Zeta Beta Tau fraternity was taken to a beach area of New Jersey and told to dig his own grave. Seconds after he complied with orders to lie flat in the finished hole, the sides collapsed, suffocating him before his prospective fraternity brothers could dig him out. There is another striking similarity between the initiation rites of tribal and fraternal societies. They simply will not die. Resisting all attempts to eliminate or suppress them, such hazing practices have been phenomenally resilient. Authorities in the form of colonial governments or university administrations have tried threats, social pressures, legal actions, banishments, bribes, and bans to persuade the groups to remove the hazards and humiliations from their initiation ceremonies. None has been successful. Oh, there may be a change while the authority is watching closely, but this is usually more apparent than real. The harsher trials occurring under more secret circumstances, until the pressure is off and they can surface again. On some college campuses, officials have tried to eliminate dangerous hazing practices by substituting a help week of civic service or by taking direct control of the initiation rituals. When such attempts are not slyly circumvented by fraternities, they are met with outright physical resistance. For example, in the aftermath of Richard Swanson's choking death at USC, the university president issued new rules requiring that all pledging activities be reviewed by school authorities before going into effect, and that adult advisors be present during initiation ceremonies. According to one national magazine, the new code set off a riot so violent that city police and fire departments were afraid to enter campus. Resigning themselves to the inevitable, other college representatives have given up on the possibility of abolishing the degradations of Hell Week. If hazing is a universal human activity, and every bit of evidence points to this conclusion, you most likely won't be able to ban it effectively. Refuse to allow it openly, and it will go underground. You can't ban sex, and you can't prohibit alcohol, and you probably can't eliminate hazing. What is it about hazing practices that make them so precious to these societies? What could make the groups want to evade, undermine, or contest any effort to ban the degrading and perilous features of their initiation rites? Some have argued that the groups themselves are composed